Good morning. I'm Alexis Strauss-Hacker, Chair of the San Francisco Bay Regional Water Quality Control Board, and I want to welcome you to today's board meeting. Board Member Jane Batty will be participating remotely in today's meeting. So we will call the roll for our board members in just a moment, but first some logistics. As you know, our meetings are hybrid, so in addition to those here in the conference room, we may also receive comment through our Zoom meeting platform. If you're not physically present and intend to comment, you need to be in the Zoom meeting space and not watching through our webcast. If you haven't already received a link for the Zoom meeting, you can visit our website and register through the link on the agenda for today's meeting. After you register, you'll receive a Zoom login link providing access to our meeting. If you're in person and wish to speak, you may also register online or with the assistance of our team at the registration table just outside. For those in the Zoom meeting, you'll be muted until it's your turn to speak. Our staff will then promote you. Please unmute yourself on your computer or phone so that we can hear you. And when you finish speaking and the board members have completed asking any questions they may have, you'll be placed back on mute. For those in the room here waiting to speak, you'll be called by name when it's your turn. Please come to the podium where we can best see and hear you. Each speaker is given 3 minutes for commentary, and we ask you state your name and your affiliation when called upon. Thank you for joining us today. We look forward to a good meeting. I'd now like to ask Paula Castellanos, our clerk for today's board meeting, to call the roll.
Board Member Ransom.
Here.
Board Member Billing is not here yet. Board Member Gunther.
Here.
Board Member Batty is remote.
Here.
Board Member Kissinger.
Here.
Vice Chair Young.
Here.
And Chair Hacker.
Here. Thank you. We have a quorum physically present for today's meeting. Welcome to everyone. The next item on our agenda is the public forum. I'd like to open our meeting to the public forum and remind everyone that the public forum is for items that are not on the agenda today. You can speak on those items at the appropriate time and items that are not a pending or an impending matter, meaning they're not about to come up on our agenda in the next few months. Please consult our board clerk, Paula Castellanos, who is seated here in the front of the auditorium if you have questions. I will call on our public speakers who've registered to speak. One additional note, if you are remote, haven't been called, please raise your virtual hand on the Zoom platform. That way we will know to call on you. Again, each speaker has 3 minutes, and you can be timed and notified by the online timer visible on the screen. We appreciate your understanding and cooperation. I believe our first speaker is Mr. Jeff Ellsworth.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you. Please go ahead.
Very good. Thank you. Hello, Board Chair Strauss-Hacker and Board. I'm Jeff Ellsworth, former mayor of St. Helena, Napa County, circling back on Upper Valley Disposal Service, Clover Flat landfill issues in Napa County from the September 11th Water Board meeting. We appreciate the item on that agenda, but with no staff report or discussion, the ongoing fire contamination and health safety concerns remain unaddressed. Yes. In an item before this board on September 11th, a protocol of sworn oath for truthfulness was implemented. Concerns related to UBDS Clover Flat landfill should also include sworn testimony for truth in proceedings. We recognize the company is under investigation, but important to understand investigations of these sites have gone on for 5 years with the Department of Fish and Wildlife and Napa County District Attorney, and now with the Water Board, Department of Toxic Substance Control, and U.S. Justice Department, FBI. Yet contamination and fire risks continue. This despite clear evidence of ongoing fires and large-scale contamination, including another fire this June 2024, and storm drains and unmapped ghost piping leading directly from garbage recycling areas to public waterways. There have been comments that many of these matters may not have come under Water Board purview. I would disagree, as both these waste sites, Clover Flat Landfill and UVDS Whitehall Lane, have never had proper wastewater containment infrastructure and sit in headwaters or floodway areas to the Napa River, the second largest freshwater inlet to the San Francisco Bay, as well as a significant water source for the Napa Valley community and wine industry. These waste sites concerns do have direct relevance to the Water Board, including concerns with wastewaters from suppression of dozens of fires at these waste sites draining directly to public waterways, climate action referenced in the Water Board strategic work plan. The long mismanaged UVDS Whitehall Lane Clover Flat landfill sites are among the largest GHG emitters in Napa County with no plan for mitigation. Racial and environmental justice are also recognized in your strategic work plan. How does this reconcile with the primarily Latino workforce at UVDS Clover Flat landfill, exposed to untreated leachate wastewater for decades, exposed to radioactive waste, working with substandard equipment, including garbage trucks catching fire and losing steering mid-route, as well as workers told by the company not to report fires and to suppress the fires with contaminated leachate wastewater? Systemic exploitation of undocumented workers at UVDS for decades is a particularly heinous affront from a company operating only by virtue of exclusive government contracts. Inspectors should have addressed this long ago. And this brings up concerns with inspections, including documents of a Water Board inspector and official communications stating UVDS Whitehall Lane is only a compost operation when the site has for decades been a full recycling and waste transfer station with daily washing out of the UVDS garbage truck fleet with wastewaters mingling with compost sold as organic. We'd like to have this item re-agendized as possible, soon as possible. And please reach out to me directly for more information. I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ellsworth. I appreciate the level of detail that you've been providing us as board members. And I'd like to ask our executive officer to add her comments.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Ellsworth, for your comments. And we agree there's been lots of complaints against the site. And as I think you're well aware, there's an ongoing investigation involving multiple agencies. And the regional board must exercise its due diligence on each and every claim. And I want you to know that if the regional board discovered immediate threats to human health and or the environment, those threats would be immediately addressed through one of the board's emergency authorities and in accordance with our agency's mission. The regional board used such authority in 2019 when it issued Clover Flat Landfill an emergency cleanup and abatement order pursuant to Water Code Section 13304, requiring immediate corrective actions to protect waters of the state. We're committed to completing this investigation. It's complex, involving multiple agencies, as you noted, and we plan to share the final investigation report when it's completed with our board, and staff will reach out and share it with you, Mr. Ellsworth. But until then, it will not be an agendized item before our board. Thank you.
Is there a comment that I can make, or is that inappropriate at this time?
My suggestion is that you speak with our executive officer or forward to her any additional correspondence. I know you would like to engage in a more robust discussion at this time, but that's not as ideally suited to the public forum. And you've been very thorough in your correspondence, and I encourage you to continue with us in that regard.
Okay, I'll do that. I'll submit my comments from today as well. I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you for your attention to this. It seems very important. Do we have additional comment? I would like our board clerk to note that board member Bielan has joined the meeting as of 9:05. Do we have other commenters?
Noted, thank you.
And no one in the room who wishes to participate? Very well, we're going to move on. Thank you all. Public forum is now closed. Our next agenda item, item three, pertains to the minutes of the September 11th board meeting. These have been included in our packets and posted online as drafts. Are there any edits or revisions from board members? Seeing or hearing none, may we please have a motion and a second to adopt the meeting minutes?
So moved.
Second.
Moved by Board Member Young and seconded by Board Member Bielan. Paola, will you proceed with the vote, please?
Board Member Ransom?
Abstain.
Board Member Bielan?
Aye.
Board Member Gunther?
Aye.
Board Member Batty?
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Young?
Aye.
Chair Hacker?
Aye. Thank you. The September 11th board meeting minutes have been adopted by the board. Let's move to item four, which are our board member updates, followed by our executive officer's report. Board member Ranson?
Nothing for me.
Board member Beeling?
Nothing for me.
Board member Batty?
And nothing for me, except I just can't help but be thinking about our friends and family in Florida who are facing significant impacts coming up, both related to water and to climate change. So just thinking of them today.
Indeed. Board member Gunther?
I would just echo what Board Member Batty said and then encourage everybody to track how this problem, how this storm develops. We're going to see interactions here between events that are part of the challenges of climate change that are so hard to predict. There's massive piles of trash in these communities from Hurricane Helene, and they're going to turn into either battering rams in the storm surge or projectiles, virtually bullets in the wind. My college roommate, I've managed to get three sentences from him from the mountains of north of Asheville in North Carolina, where the entire region, as everybody knows, has been transformed in a manner that will take a generation to deal with. We should be aware here, we're lucky that our ocean temperatures kind of provide sort of a barrier, but that barrier might be to wind speed, but not to rainfall. And there will be, you know, our moment will come when we'll get a year of rain in a week. And I know that we're all already thinking about it, which is really great, but we need to keep bringing that message into our community and have all of our local elected leaders and the citizens in this region think about how to be resilient in the face of these kind of events, because they're coming.
Thank you. Board Member Kissinger.
I have nothing to add to that very apt and poignant set of remarks.
Indeed. Board Member Young.
No update for me, thank you.
And Normie, let me turn to our executive officer.
Great, thank you. So at the September board meeting, I agreed to provide a budget update at the October board meeting. And my update's pretty brief. Basically, the state agencies are still trying to determine how they will reduce the operating budget by 8%. At this time, no decisions have been made, but we've been asked not to fill vacant positions at this time until they figure out the 8% reduction. I just want to remind you, in August, we identified six vacant positions to be permanently eliminated. So that's definitely impacted our ability to get work done. And just to keep you informed, we currently have seven vacancies that we're holding. They're hopeful that maybe in the next couple of weeks they might let us start filling some of those. The good news, there's currently no layoffs or furloughs proposed, and we're currently evaluating the challenges and opportunities to manage resources in new and different ways to cover our responsibilities as stewards of the San Francisco Water Board. And then switching gears, if there's no questions, I'll pause. Is there any questions on the budget anybody wanted to ask? Okay, if not, I'll go to a little more cheerful item. Next, I'd like to share with you some detail regarding a recent scholarship award. The California Association of Sanitation Agencies Education Foundation helps ensure clean water for Californians by awarding scholarships to promising students on a path to serving the environmental community. The Bruce Wolfe Memorial Scholarship was established to honor Bruce Wolfe, a former executive officer of the San Francisco Water Board, a passionate steward of the Bay environment, and an advocate for expanding diversity in the clean water sector. This scholarship is available to Bay Area candidates whose backgrounds are currently underrepresented in the clean water career paths. To remind you, Bruce Wolfe received degrees in civil and environmental engineering from Stanford University and went on to pursue a successful career with the San Francisco Water Board. And he was marked by notable achievements in the protection of public health and the environment. Bruce was a dedicated leader in the clean water community. He knew how important education was in bettering people and communities. He supported diversity and education throughout his life, and his legacy is honored through this memorial scholarship. Funded by generous contributions from the Bay Area Clean Water Agencies, private donations, including some members of our board, and the East Bay Discharges Association, the Bruce Wolf Memorial Scholarship awards $5,000 to a student from the Bay Area who identifies as a gender other than male or whose racial identity includes any mix of Black, Indigenous, and or people of color. This year, the scholarship was awarded to Crystal Kamua, a civil engineering student at the University of California, Davis. I would like to introduce Crystal, who is here today, and will say a few words. Crystal?
Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. My name is Crystal Katamura, and I am a civil engineering major studying at the University of California, Davis. 2 weeks ago, I started my fall quarter and my final year of university. I am here today to share my story and my growth to confidence as a civil engineer. Before starting university, I was sure about my decision to becoming an engineer. In fact, I had even vowed to not let anything get in the way between me and my degree. However, as time went on, I began to face problems much larger than just homework, midterms, and project deadlines. The cost of a college education is a financial burden to me and my family. And as a first-generation Filipino-American studying engineering, the path between me and my degree only seemed to be getting longer and never shorter. But still, I was determined to make it to the end, no matter how much work it might take. Then, things got even more difficult. And in spring of 2023, my friend and fellow engineer, Minkyu Gion, lost his life to two inebriated drivers. Nearly 2 weeks later, my grandmother, who had been living with me and my family, lost her two-year battle to lung cancer. Already doubting myself, and now, without two very important pillars in my support system, I questioned whether or not I would be able to graduate, and most of all, whether or not I was even meant to be an engineer. A couple months later, I hear about a job opening at the Fairfield Sassoon Sewer District. FSSD was hiring for an outreach intern. Now, I remember looking at that job application and thinking to myself, what right do I have applying to that position? How could I ever fit alongside professionals in this industry? But I applied anyway, telling myself that at the end of the day, interviews are good practice for the future. Little did I know that my decision that summer would be a pivotal point for me in my career as an engineer. My mentors, Meg Hurston and Emily Corwin, alongside staff from engineering, administration, operations, and maintenance, welcomed me to the district with a kindness and excitement to showcase their work. Their passion for their jobs was contagious. And before I knew it, I got swept up learning about community treatment wetlands, green stormwater infrastructure, and of course, the wastewater treatment process itself. Everything it is today and what it can become in the future. Alongside our community members, we hosted community meetings, developed education programs, and even hosted cleanup events like Coastal Cleanup. Before I knew it, I got swept up in a whirlwind of forward thinking. I began to outgrow my doubts and anxieties about myself, but most importantly, FSSD taught me the power of collective action and the role that you, I, and every single individual in this room plays in promoting change. This epiphany and newfound confidence would not have been possible without the people at FSSD who nourished my growth and those who continue to believe in me and my potential. But today, most of all, I would like to especially thank the CASA Education Foundation, its donors, and Bruce Wolf's family. Thank you for sponsoring my education. I can guarantee you all here today that the work I will do in the future will only be a testament to your generosity and trust. Meg once told me that I remind her of Bruce Wolfe because of my ability to speak to and understand different groups of people. It is an honor to not only be receiving this scholarship in his name, but to now also have the chance to carry on his legacy of leadership and community engagement. And I can promise you all that it is not an honor that I take lightly. And I vow to you all today that the work, the education, and the skills I gain in the future will only be used to give back to our communities, our environment, and our water industries. I don't quite know what the future has in store for me, whether that's continuing on to a master's, working in the industry, or maybe a little bit of both, who knows? But one thing I do know for sure is that my goal is to always carry on what FSSD has taught me. To look beyond the projects and the plans, civil engineering is not just about building the infrastructure, it's a matter of environmental justice and equity. Civil engineering is not just about providing people with the services they need, but actively chasing innovative ideas to find and make ways to mitigate climate change. Civil engineering is about the connections between the people, the cities, and the environment. And my goal as a civil engineer is to always remember that every duty and challenge I take on starts and ends with the people I will serve.
Would you like to say a few words? Okay. That was so meaningful to hear from you. And if any board members want to offer further encouragement, now's the moment.
Well, I don't think I could do justice to the speech you just gave, so I'm not going to try, but I will say, as someone who admired Bruce and knew him very well, I'm sure he's smiling wherever he is by the speech you just gave, and we're delighted to have helped you.
Yeah, Christy, thank you for coming down here. And I don't know what there is in the employment procedures at Fairfield Sassoon, but I hope Lorian, you're sitting here next to Lorian, I hope Back was taking notes because this kind of engineering student represents to me the evolution of civil engineering in this time. And Christy, I hope that we can keep you in the Bay Area because your contributions are going to be enormous. I am quite sure of that.
Yeah, I would just say, as a civil environmental engineer myself, I've been around a lot of engineers over the last 45 years, and there's not very many of them that could give a speech like you just gave right there. So I would just encourage you to look into consulting, because I think you have a bright future.
Water board.
Yeah. Very nice.
I'd like to, in particular, you had noted others that you gave credit to, and I wanted to indeed thank BAQA and EBDA, Fairfield Sassoon, of course, and the CASA Educational Foundation, which you acknowledged, for supporting this along with Bruce's family. It shows what a difference it can make, and we all heartily wish you a very successful senior year. We appreciate you coming down to Oakland on what might be a day with other classes and work obligations. And I think that putting together your academic work and the practicum of being at Fairfield Sassoon is a wonderful way to inform and shape your own professional direction. And I hope you'll stay, one, stay in touch with us, and two, find ways to encourage those first-year students who may be going through some of the difficulties of, is this the path I'm on? Mm-hmm. So we're very grateful to you. It was very inspiring and very personal. You have such a touch. So best wishes and thank you. Well, That puts Keith Licton in the position of having to follow that. But what we could do is take a one-minute break for those of you who wish to stand for a moment, and we'll start again on agenda item 5 on stream stewardship in just a minute. Thank you. We're ready to resume our meeting. Our next item, stream stewardship in Contra Costa County. I'll turn to our executive officer, Eileen White.
Great, thank you. This item will provide information about the Contra Costa County Flood Control and Water Conservation District Stream Side Management Program for landowners. The program, implemented by the California Urban Streams Partnership, fills a stewardship gap by creating an important link between the county and the private property owners to address stream bank erosion and failures with sustainable green solutions. Last month, we discussed the Supplemental Environmental Projects, or SEPs, as part of our enforcement update. It's worth noting that this program was initially established using Supplemental Environmental Project money from a fine in Pittsburgh, although it's now supported by the county. Katie Hart, Water Resource Control Engineer in the Watershed Management Division, will introduce the item, followed by Ann Riley of the California Urban Streams Partnership and Tim Jensen from the county. Thank you, Katie.
So we have a few slides, and I will turn down the lights if this works. No? So good morning, Chair Hacker and members of the board. I'm Katie Hart, an engineer in the Watershed Management Division. And today I'm introducing a discussion on the Streamside Maintenance Program for landowners in Contra Costa County, which is just one of Contra Costa County Flood Control District's tools to support stream stewardship. Next slide, please. The Contra Costa County Flood Control and Water Conservation District is a Bay Area leader in stream stewardship. In 2022, they completed the Lower Walnut Creek Restoration Project, which restored creek habitat to more than 3.2 miles of Lower Walnut Creek. Additional public access improvements are now in progress. However, large-scale restoration projects like this are unusual. Most stream stewardship is smaller scale, dealing with the sedimented challenges of our urbanized Bay Area. For example, past creek hardening, streams that aren't big enough to convey post-urbanization flood flows, discharges of trash and debris, and the fact that stream ownership is a patchwork. The Flood Control District owns portions of creeks, but otherwise it's a combination of public and private property owners, including single-family homeowners, many of whom have limited knowledge about stream stewardship. To address these challenges, the county implements a range of tools. For example, they support watershed councils to help steward creeks. They regularly maintain streams under their responsibility, and they support the stream maintenance program for landowners. Next slide, please. You'll remember the county is one of a number of Bay Area flood control districts with a programmatic authorization from the board to complete routine stream maintenance activities. That's completed under the county's routine maintenance manual and allows us to ensure water quality is protected while enabling the county to predictably complete authorized routine maintenance activities and mitigation. But as I noted, that doesn't cover everything. A key missing link is the need to engage individual property owners who may be experiencing stream bank erosion and failures. Next slide, please. So to that end, the county is implementing the Streamside Maintenance Program for Landowners, which is a public nonprofit partnership that uses experts from the California Urban Streams Partnership to help educate private property owners on sustainable green solutions for addressing stream bank failures. And as Eileen mentioned, it's an example of the board supporting new initiatives using administrative civil liability fine money. It was started in 1999 as a supplemental environmental project with about $100,000 from a fine in Pittsburgh. I'm now going to turn it over to Tim Jensen with Contra Costa County Flood Control to give an overview of their stewardship programs and efforts. He'll be followed by Ann Riley with the California Urban Streams Partnership to tell you about the Streamside Maintenance Program. Thank you.
Thank you, Katie. Good morning, Chair Hacker and members of the board. My name is Tim Jensen, and I am Assistant Public Works Director of the Contra Costa Public Works Department and also Assistant Chief Engineer of the Contra Costa Flood Control District. And I'll probably be repeating some of the things that Katie said so well, but going into a little bit more detail. Next slide, please. So we have a map on the screen of the creeks, flood control channels, streams, rivers in Contra Costa County. The dark blue facilities are what the flood control district we operate and maintain. Walnut Creek, Marsh Creek, and you know, I could name several of those. But the light blue have fortunately not been converted to flood control channels. They're natural creeks, which is good, but the stewardship can be challenging. Some of the stewardship, there's about 1,300 miles of creeks throughout the county, and only 80 miles of those are managed by the flood control district. So a lot of those areas are covered by cities or East Bay Regional Parks, Mount Diablo State Park, East Bay Mud has some watershed lands. But a lot of it comes down to being on private property, which is kind of the hardest to steward because they're not getting permits, not understanding the process, and trying to do things quickly and cheaply. Next slide, please. Our routine maintenance program that Katie mentioned allows our crews to carry out the routine work that we need to do, but of course we're following best management practices, and we do habitat assessments. We do integrated pest management and nature-based solutions and mitigation. We do have limited funding, so we've found that working with watershed stewards, creek groups, et cetera, is a big benefit to us in actually accomplishing some of our work. So even though there is a requirement to remove invasive species, there's a requirement to work with local watershed groups, we've already been doing that for over 20 years. And it's just been very successful. One of the creek groups in the San Ramon Danville area has tackled all the Arundo in the watershed. They mapped it, and they have volunteer days where they're just taking it out little by little, and it's been a very successful story, and they've even received grant money from agencies to do that. Next slide, please. The primary group we work with is the Contra Costa Resource Conservation District, which is a county special district organization, and they have a lot of knowledge and experience and staff to facilitate volunteer groups and watershed councils, et cetera. And then we work with Earth Island Institute, CUSP, the Watershed Project, Urban Tilth, Earth Team, and groups like that. And some of the, I added up, there's 13 watershed groups in the county that we support, and those are just a few of the activities we do. We have things going on year-round. Next slide, please. The biggest event that we have is our Giving the Natives a Chance planting and trash cleanup annual event. We do that the first week of December so the newly planted plants can get the early winter rains and get going. We typically have a lot of youth at that event, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, et cetera, and people from the community. And we're planting Santa Barbara sedge, Baltic rush, creeping wild rye natives. And some of the areas have achieved 100% native, so it's great to see that happening over time. Next slide, please. Historically, we have codes and standards, ordinances, and trying to require stream stewardship is hard. People aren't going to sit down and read their ordinance when they buy a home that has a creek in their backyard. But we do thankfully have setback requirements, so there's typically a pretty good buffer from a home or an outbuilding to the creek, so there's an opportunity for people to understand there's a creek there. We created a Living with Creeks brochure years ago that we send out to a lot of residents with creeks in their backyards. This diagram that we have here is a little outdated, so we're working with Fish and Wildlife to get it updated. One of the main items is woody debris is good to have remaining in the creek and not remove all woody debris because it provides good bug habitat as it decays and feeds into the cycle. Next slide, please. So, yeah, as mentioned by Katie, this was started years ago, and it really was an advantageous type of program that would give the county, the flood control district, even the clean water program a place to send people that called and said, I need help. I have something going on in my backyard. I'm not sure what to do. So it's we've just seen it be successful. And the most valuable time was in the winter storms that we had December 31, 2022, and through April 2023, when it was just raining and people were concerned and erosion was happening and they're wondering what to do. So I'm sure this saved a lot of people from wondering what to do and helped them make a good decision of using nature-based solutions instead of hardened concrete, riprap, or a lot of people use soldier pile walls. So we're thankful that a lot less of that happened. We have a great relationship with CUSP and working on this, and Riley is going to be coming up next to talk more about that. Thank you.
Riley's on Zoom.
Please go ahead.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. I'm Ann Riley. I'm representing the California Urban Streams Partnership. Back in 1999, the Urban Creeks Council, which was later named the California Urban Streams Partnership, arranged a meeting with the San Francisco Bay Regional Water Board management. And they suggested a challenge to think outside the box. The regional board was beginning to use their Section 401, 404 under the Clean Water Act to protect streams from degradation through its certification permit process. And so some progress was made in that way to protect streams. But nonetheless, there's just that map that Tim had of all the stream channels in the county. Many private property owners were just doing informal bank stabilization work on the creeks in their backyards. And they have rock and concrete and retaining walls, car bodies that we call General Motors bank stabilization, gabions. This approach of just random incremental property owners dropping stuff on their banks was creating problems for their upstream neighbors and downstream neighbors, the neighbors across the creek, continuing ongoing stream degradation. So the Urban Creeks Council suggested a pilot with the Water Board in Contra Costa County, where we would take a face-to-face personal approach, visit property owners, and consult with them on what effective bank stabilization and flood reduction activities they could take that would be affordable and effective. The program was so successful in its first year or two, the Contra Costa County stepped in and said, we'll fund it, we'll take this over. The program entails about 30 property owner visits a year. We provide written reports to each property that we visit, and we provide copies of those reports to the Water Board and the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. And what I want to do now is start the next slides, which show what these property owner projects look like. Now, this is the Carol Diaz property on Alhambra Creek in the city of Martinez. And she had a tree pull out a stream bank. We showed up, next slide, and worked with Carol to put in what we call soil bioengineering system. These started to appear officially in the Army Corps of Engineers and Natural Resources Conservation Service manuals about the year 2000. And what you see here is what we call a brush and post system. It's a very easy do-it-yourself project for property owners. You see that there's willow posts that are hammered into the bank with brush just tied down between them. This is a gardener that works for Carol Diaz that helped us. Next slide. And here's our crew working with Carol. Carol's the second person from the right. Look at how steep this bank is. Next slide. Another good viewpoint of how steep this is. So, you know, traditionally, this would have been a property coming in with concrete riprap and just dumping it down the side and then blowing out their neighbor's bank. Next slide shows partners that we've brought in from the Contra Costa County Resource Conservation District. And part of our program has a budget from the county to train the RCD staffs so that we can enlarge our capacity to serve more property owners. And also they end up on our crews to help property owners do projects on their stream banks. Next slide. That's what it looked like about a year later. And Carol Diaz and the city of Martinez were pretty thrilled. Next slide. A innovative twist to the SIMPLE program, very much supported by Katie Hart and Keith Lipton, was that the city of Martinez had gone into Alhambra Creek and dredged the creek and removed vegetation for flood control without permits. And so this was moving toward a violation. And the way the violation document was written was, rather than fines, the Water Board proposed that the city produce a master plan to, in an environmentally sensitive and well thought out way, handle sediment removal and vegetation management on their stream banks. And this plan was adopted in October 2022 by the City Council, and it included a beaver management plan, which is a rarity in the Bay Area to have a plan like that in a stream maintenance plan. And the mayor of Martinez brags that it's the only city in the United States where beaver live 15 feet from a parking meter. next slide. This is the Terry Baker property, again along Alhambra Creek. A tree pulled out her stream bank. Where she was headed was to hire a contractor to put in sacrete, which is going to be very expensive. It would have hardened the bank and actually created a lot of stability issues. Next slide. And this is another shot of that tree having fallen down the bank. Next slide. There's Carol Baker. And you'll notice that these projects, hands-on projects, we involve the property owner. That's a condition of us coming in and helping. So this is their project, and we teach them how to do their own bank stabilization projects. On the left, you see a young woman with a AmeriCorps patch on, and she is working for the San Francisco Regional Board and learning these kinds of practices and helping CUSP with these hands-on projects with the property owners. Next slide. So there's our crew. It also involved the Friends of Alhambra Creek, as well as the Resources Conservation District and AmeriCorps volunteers. Next slide. And so that's the stabilized bank. About 2 years later, next slide. You can see from across the opposite side of the creek what that bank looks like now. Next slide. And Carol, or Terry rather, redesigned and restored her driveway so there was no longer the stormwater running over the top of the bank, creating bank stabilization issues. And stormwater management tends to be one of the things we focus on when we go to people's properties. I would say most of the stream bank stabilization issues are created by this stormwater going over their banks. Next slide. This is an example of a group that we're doing a educational workshop. Part of our contract with the county is to do two of these workshops a year open to the general public, where we go through these soil bioengineering strategies. And so we're training up a like a volunteer workforce to work in these difficult situations. Soil bioengineering, as I mentioned, is in the engineering handbooks now. Research done by the University of Michigan chair of the engineering department, Donald Gray, shows that the tensile strength of the roots of these willows, cottonwoods, dogwood are so dense that the tensile strength is equal to or greater than concrete. So we're replacing concrete and riprap and car bodies in Contra Costa County with these soil bioengineering systems. As I mentioned, we're probably doing about 30 to 40 visits to properties every year. That's it.
Great. Thank you, Riley. And thank you to Katie and Tim Jensen for the presentation. I think that concludes our information item. Just letting you know about some of the tools that we are thrilled that the Contra Costa County Flood Control and Water Conservation District has been supporting. And I want to thank Tim for hoofing it in from the county and not present, since he's retired, of course, is Mitch Avalon, who played a remarkable stewardship role in sort of bringing the county to its current approach of implementing this range of programs to support stream health.
Let me turn to Board Member Batty.
Good morning, everyone. Wonderful presentation, very informative. Love to see this wonderful work. I think my question was, I'm not sure who it's for, but I wonder if someone could talk about a little bit about the stream and river overwhelm that we've seen from Helene in North Carolina in particular, and just sort of try to put into context these great protective measures and then the enormous flooding that we're seeing. Maybe the answer is obvious, but I sure would like to hear some conversation about that. And when we get those big storms, as Dr. Gunther says, can anybody address that a bit?
Riley, would you like to offer a few words? You've spent a fair amount of time working on flood issues.
Sure. Well, Katie mentioned in her presentation how urban development or even development in rural areas has encroached too closely on streams. And so the most important thing is, as these areas rebuild, let's say, is that we set back development from these hazardous floodplain areas. So really land use is key to all this. And even coastal areas that are being hit with hurricanes. You know, the Association of State Wetland Managers and Floodplain Managers is emphasizing that, the states need to step in and start looking at land use ordinances. The regional board is looking at a riparian protection policy that I think could be very important along these lines, where we try to protect the riparian vegetation that holds these stream banks and water systems together, rather than see it degrade over time. Mm-hmm. So, stay tuned for the presentation of the riparian protection policy.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much. That's all helpful. And the land use and public policy side of this is so challenging, but so essential. So thank you for that.
Yeah, I just wanted to put in a good word for both Katie Hart and Keith. The simple program really would not have survived this number of years without their very attentive support. And so you need to know that, this has succeeded because of them and also because of people like Tim Jensen. So, the people involved in these things are key to their success. So I really want to put a shout out to them for helping make this successful.
Comments from the board members?
I guess I had one question. And it's a point that was made early on the presentation, that the vast majority of these streams are on private property. And I know you have the brochure that you put out to private landowners to know what their obligations are or what services are available. But how do you reach out to people? How do they know about it? I mean, I'm impressed by Anne's work. But how do you really get out there? Because there must be an enormous number of, stream bed collapses that we've seen here that are not getting picked up.
Yeah, good question.
To question if you like.
Yeah, Tim should answer that question.
Another thing that we established years ago was a Contra Costa Watershed Forum. It's a group that meets every other month, and they talk about watershed activities. So we use that forum to talk about things like this. We also have information on our website. And then every 4 years, we have a Creek and Watershed Symposium, and we usually have attendees, 200 to 250 people, and we'll be talking about these kind of activities and showcasing many other Creek Group activities that are happening. So that's how we've been getting the word out. But probably a lot of people are just calling for help. They'll call the Resource Conservation District, they'll call the Flood Control District, they'll call the county, they'll call the Clean Water Program. They're just desperate, so they just start calling whatever number they can think of, and eventually they get to the right people, and we can help them.
It's really impressive.
Some of the cities mail. I think they'd be interested in knowing those dates when they come up, those larger forums.
Oh, sure. Yes. Katie's attended in the past, and I definitely will.
Some of the cities mail the simple pamphlet to the property owners to make them aware of the program.
Well, thank you. Other comments?
Yeah, I had a couple. With regard to Board Member Batty's question, one thing to keep in mind is that the terrain in North Carolina, which is very different than ours, if you've ever traveled in that area, very, very steep creek canyons that contribute to each other, and so that you get water flowing downhill very fast. And the power, by the time the tributaries are merging, the power is really extraordinary. able to wash away interstate bridges and everything. We don't quite have that topography here, except maybe in Marin. So this is really great. Now we can see one of the reasons Riley was awarded the Gene Auer Award this year. I'm interested in two things. One, just following up on this question of outreach, that now that we can tell people that plants are stronger than concrete, there's I have seen over the time that I've been having, watching this go from a pilot project to standard engineering. And there's a real opportunity here to make creekside landowners aware. I was wondering whether you, in Contra Costa, whether you could work with the county assessor to deliver information as part of the property tax bill about, you know, if you live here, you know, if this is part of your property, you know, be aware of what happens when we have massive rainstorms and how things change, and that there are ways for you to do things that really enhance. I think this would, I would assume some of the people you work with would say this enhances my property value. Now, of course, you have to word that right, coming from the assessor's office, I guess. But I think that there would be an official way to move information to parcels that are creekside. And then I'm also interested in whether this is going on in other counties in the Bay Area, and is Contra Costa leading the charge here, or is this just an example of what's happening all over?
Let me answer the first question real quick. Yeah, we'll look into that. And with GIS technology, there's definitely capabilities of generating address lists of any time a creek intersects private property. You know, there's that technology we could use. So yeah, that's a good suggestion. We'll follow up on that.
And Dr. Gunther, I'll just offer, we didn't bring before you today other flood protection agencies, including the Sonoma County Water Agency, which has a somewhat different but similar sort of community grant-based program to encourage this kind of work on areas that they are not responsible for, but which ultimately they are affected by. So, which is to say, though, this is not something that's being implemented across the board, and that's one of the reasons we're telling you about it here, is to help spread the word. Of course, Contra Costa County and Tim are closely involved in BAFPA, the Bay Area Flood Protection Agencies Association, which is an information sharing forum for this kind of thing. And just the last, and here we are in Oakland, which of course is part of its stream protection ordinance, took advantage of the GIS-based technology that Tim has just mentioned with respect to its stream protection ordinance. And so they are able to communicate directly with each streamside property owner. The last thing I'll note, I know we're a little bit tight on time. I got the green light from Eileen, so. is just thinking about flood events on a national level. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, NOAA, and the American Society of Civil Engineers are coordinating on, as engineers, we like models, right? So we're trying to figure out how are we modeling the largest amount, the largest flood flows. So they're coordinating on models to better estimate exactly the kinds of changes we're discussing today in peak flows with significant events. And it's likely that the current status is they're moving towards a probabilistic model, very much like the Ocean Protection Council, with respect to sea level rise, where you have this cone of probability over time, and you have a sort of percentage. You know, how much do you care about what it is you're trying to protect? And so you have a very large event instead of where we are now, which is just saying, well, this is the maximum event, and you just, you know, for your dam or something, you can protect to that. It's estimated, at least based on what I heard this past weekend, that's about 10 years out. So they're also looking at developing some interim guidance that will sort of gesture towards that as we think about how are we protecting the things that we care about most.
And what's the probability that in the next 10 years we're going to... No, this is just great stuff. I'm just really impressed with what was just some pointy-handed engineers and green activists 20 years ago has now become standard practice for civil engineers and flood control districts. And I hope that we can continue to
think about creative ways. I thought about another thing, be a garden tour, but it's a stream bank tour in your neighborhood. I mean, that there are there the to let people know that this isn't just experimental anymore. It really works. And you know, again, I like the fact that willows are stronger than concrete. I think that that could go a long way. But thanks a lot for this. It's been really valuable.
Thank you. I so appreciate Katie and Keith and Tim and Riley for your longstanding partnership in this endeavor, bringing forward the affordable and effective solutions and being able to communicate that more broadly is wonderful, and we're very grateful you could come and give us a presentation today, so thank you. Okay, let's move on. Eileen, we're ready to move on to the next item, item six.
Great. Well, as many of the board members commented earlier, that we've seen the devastating impacts in Florida of Hurricane Helene, and we're going to be seeing by late tonight the projected, there's been, you know, projected impacts of very devastating impacts from Hurricane Milton. Bay Area infrastructure and public health are also threatened by a number of climate-related changes, including more extreme heat events, increased air pollution from ozone formation and wildfires, longer, more frequent droughts, and flooding from sea level rise and high-intensity rain events. We incorporate climate actions into all our program activities at the regional board, and we utilize our authority to advance climate adaptation planning, coordination, technical assistance, and permitting. We recognize that addressing climate change is critical for the long-term protection of water quality. This past summer, seven regional and state public agencies executed a memorandum of understanding, committing each agency to a joint work program to address increased threats of flooding and sea level rise in the nine-county San Francisco Bay Area region. The agencies participating in the agreement include the Association of Bay Area Governments, the Bay Area Air Quality Management District, the California State Coastal Conservancy, Caltrans District 4, the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission, and the San Francisco Bay Water Board. The partners' amplified coordination will be guided by the Interagency Bay Area Regional Collaborative. The memorandum is intended to align the partners' efforts, expertise, and core functions to deliver priority multi-benefit projects to reduce flooding risks in vulnerable communities along the San Francisco Bay shoreline. Groundwater rise and sea level rise have a nexus with many of the Water Board programs, and we plan to bring to the board next spring additional sea level rise items. Sea level rise threatens to drown the tidal marshes that sustain the health of the bay, increase the risk of catastrophic floods in low-lying neighborhoods, inundate crucial shoreline infrastructure such as highways, railroads, airports, and wastewater treatment plants, as well as increased erosion and beach land loss along the Pacific coast. Rising atmospheric carbon dioxide also drives ocean acidification, which threatens the Bay Area's fragile aquatic food webs, as well as its robust commercial fisheries. The combined impacts of climate change will affect water quality and many beneficial uses of our waters, including those supporting ecological habitats, rare and endangered species, and recreational uses. Addressing climate change and its ramifications in the region are high priorities for the San Francisco Bay Water Board. Today's item will provide an update on predicted sea level rise and groundwater rise potential adverse effects on our cleanup sites and our approach to addressing these potential adverse effects. Javier Fernandez, manager of the Planning Division, Alex Karpowitz and Jacob T. Henry, engineering geologist in the Groundwater Protection Division, and Rachel Lim, engineering geologist in the Toxic Cleanup Division, will be providing the presentation. Go ahead, Javier.
Can you pull up the presentation? There it is. Thank you, Eileen. Good morning, Chair Hacker, Vice Chair Young, and fellow board members. I hope you're looking forward to this discussion of sea level rise and groundwater rise impacts to climate, to cleanup sites as much as we are. In our talk today, we're going to provide a brief overview of waterborne actions addressing sea level and groundwater rise in general, a refresher on the science of sea level and groundwater rise, our approach to cleanup sites, including actions to address groundwater rise threats, and site-specific considerations for cleanup sites. Waterboard staff are currently working on several actions to address the threat of groundwater rise to Bay Area communities and the environment. You have already heard a little bit about these during the strategic plan update and previous information items discussing the Department of Defense and other programs. First of all, we are participating in regional shoreline adaptation planning efforts through the Bay Area Regional Collaborative that Eileen just discussed, and Bay Adapt Regional Strategy, including serving on the advisory group for the Bay Conservation and Development Commission's Regional Shoreline Adaptation Plan. We are also requesting vulnerability assessments from the Department of Defense in collaboration with the Environmental Protection Agency and Department of Toxin Substance Control. Looking forward, this spring, you'll be hearing more about long-term flood protection for shoreline landfills, including details regarding specific threats and adaptation actions associated with sea level and groundwater rise. Also in spring, you'll be hearing about groundwater rise mapping efforts around the Bay, with particular emphasis on the Contra Costa County mapping study that we are currently funding. And now I'll turn it over to Alex Karpowitz to provide an overview of the science of sea level and groundwater rise. Alex?
Thanks, Javier. Good morning, everyone. Today we're going to give you an overview of groundwater rise at our cleanup sites. As you're aware, consideration of future sea level rise is not new to the Water Board, as staff have been adding requirements into site cleanup and waste discharge requirements over the last 15 years for both cleanup and landfill sites. In 2021, we formed an internal sea level rise and groundwater rise technical team made up of staff in the Groundwater Protection and Toxics Cleanup Divisions. Members include myself, Jacob and Rachel, and our scientific aides, Kenny Jen Kwong and Adam Ruckert. The purpose of our team is to help staff identify sites vulnerable to climate change-induced sea level and groundwater rise, determine when and how sites could be impacted, and create a strategy to use regulatory tools to address potential adverse effects at our cleanup sites. But first, a primer. What are sea level and groundwater rise? Sea level rise is generally caused by water added to the oceans from melting ice sheets and glaciers, and the expansion of seawater as it heats up. These photos show just a couple of examples of what we've seen recently and what we can expect to see more of as the climate changes, sea levels rise, and we have more extreme precipitation events. This graphic illustrates that as the sea level rises, shallow nearshore groundwater, which overlies the denser salt water, will be pushed up closer to the ground surface, potentially making it emergent in low-lying areas. According to the Ocean Protection Council's new 2024 sea level rise guidance, groundwater is expected to rise as much as sea level rises within about a half a mile of the San Francisco Bay margin and low-lying coastal areas with shallow aquifers. Between 2050 and 2100, statewide sea levels are projected to rise between 0.8 and 3.1 feet, assuming the more moderate intermediate scenario. And even higher amounts cannot be ruled out. So, how are cleanup sites impacted by these projections? The following series of animations shows the range of the Ocean Protection Council sea level rise scenarios previously mentioned and groundwater hazard data created by the United States Geological Survey's Coastal Storm Modeling System. Open cleanup and underground storage tank sites are shown as green circles and purple squares. The gradations of blue indicate depth of sea level rise inundation increasing from light to dark, and areas of shallow groundwater are shown ranging from emergent in red to very shallow and shallow in orange and yellow. Shallow to very shallow depths are considered 6 feet or less below the ground surface. We've overlain the location of our open cleanup sites using geotracker information in areas where sea level and groundwater impacts are expected. The inserts to the left show a close-up of this data along the coast, from Daly City in the north down to Half Moon Bay in the south. As you can see, many near bay and near shore cleanup sites in our region may be impacted by sea level and groundwater rise by the year 2100. So what are we currently doing about it, and how are we planning for this in the future? I'll let Jacob and Rachel share that with you next.
Thank you, Alex. Groundwater is an integral part of the hydrologic cycle, and we know sea level rise will lead to groundwater rise along our coasts. However, independent of sea level rise, as part of the hydrologic cycle, rainwater infiltrates into soil, and groundwater levels fluctuate seasonally, potentially leaching contaminants into groundwater. We routinely consider the threat that contaminants in soil pose to water quality. I'm going to talk you through our approach to cleanup sites in general, but showing you a gas station with an underground storage tank that has leaked. Water infiltrates from the surface or from below due to seasonal or sea level rise driven groundwater rise. Groundwater levels then can fluctuate through the unsaturated zone, potentially leaching contaminants through the water table and into the saturated zone where groundwater is always present. The outcomes can vary depending on the solubility and mobility of the contaminants and can include the presence of separate phase fuel, otherwise known as free product, in the soil and groundwater. Once the gasoline has been released, volatilization, diffusion, dilution, and biodegradation are likely to occur, but are dependent on subsurface conditions. One tool to help us evaluate this threat is our soil leaching to groundwater environmental screening levels. Published for over 20 years, the screening levels that we apply to soil contamination conservatively account for leaching to groundwater. Our approach to cleanup site management has become more consistent due to our low threat chlorinated solvent and underground storage tank case closure policies. These documents present narrative criteria for closing sites that pose little threat to human and ecological health, water quality, and beneficial uses, but do not yet meet cleanup standards at all locations. This process is referred to as low threat closure. Low threat closure is based on the understanding that cleanup standards can be met under natural conditions within a reasonable time frame. Once adequate source control and plume remediation are complete and considering site-specific conditions, the future land use, and the likelihood of and time frame for actual beneficial use of the affected water resources. A mainstay of the low threat closure criteria are source control measures, namely the stopping of the release, free product removal, and remediation of soil and groundwater. For those sites where adequate source control has been completed, we expect that the small remaining mass of contaminants would not pose a threat under groundwater rise conditions. In contrast, when adequate source control hasn't been achieved, evaluating groundwater rise becomes a priority. It is important to note that most sites we oversee conduct a high degree of source remediation of the unwetted subsurface contamination in accordance with our low-threat case closure criteria. This means that the remaining residual pollution is typically deeper than 6 feet, in contact with groundwater or fully submerged, and of low solubility and low mobility. Otherwise, it would have been feasible to remediate through standard cleanup methods. This further reduces the potential for future adverse effects related to groundwater rise at sites that have completed source remediation. Therefore, most sites that meet our low threat criteria, including closed sites, will have a low or very low potential for adverse effects related to sea level and groundwater rise. However, exceptions exist, especially at sites where containment strategies, such as engineered caps, were implemented.
These sites comprise our highest priorities for vulnerability assessments. Now, Rachel will present information on vulnerability assessments and provide real-world details for two existing cleanup cases.
Thank you, Jacob. You may recall that cleanup sites located along the shoreline were introduced in a previous slide. Here at Region 2, we use vulnerability assessments to evaluate the potential adverse effects of sea level and groundwater rise at our cleanup sites. We prioritize sites where our low threat criteria may not be met and residual contamination above cleanup goals remain in place. Vulnerability assessments also evaluate threat based on potential adverse effects and site-specific factors, which I will walk you through next. The potential adverse effects associated with sea level and groundwater rise include the emergence of contaminated groundwater into utility corridors, basements, and crawl spaces, increased leaching and mobilization of residual contaminants from soil and groundwater, increased vapor intrusion potential by shortening the transport distance from contaminated groundwater, and surface inundation and erosion leading to remedy failure and contaminant daylighting. As stated in our strategic work plan, staff in the two groundwater cleanup divisions have been evaluating and prioritizing cleanup sites for vulnerabilities to sea level and groundwater rise. Additional considerations for vulnerability assessments should include how contaminant type and residual contamination influences the potential for remobilization, and how remedy selection and implementation can cope with extreme climate variability and adapt to remain protective over time. Some site-specific considerations that should be evaluated in a vulnerability assessment include vulnerable features and infrastructure. They should be evaluated to determine whether damage that may occur would lead to contaminant exposure or discharge. Residual contamination left in place. In general, the greater the contaminant solubility, toxicity, volatility, and concentration, the greater the concern for adverse sea level and groundwater rise impacts. As you'll see here in the middle photo, an engineered asphalt cap is part of the remedy for the site. The cap was constructed to prevent direct exposure to workers and infiltration of storm water into impacted surface soils. The bioretention swale is the strip of vegetation shown in the middle of the photo, which minimizes uncontrolled off-site migration of stormwater. Contaminated groundwater is being remediated separately through injections. Lastly, future planned use of the site should also be considered since the remedy selected should be protective under current and future conditions. At Region 2, we have requested vulnerability assessments from 13 sites and received 8 as of this month. We have evaluated 11 sites while going through the case closure process. Cleanup sites that do not expect sea level and groundwater rise impacts have generally emphasized that concentrations will decrease through natural attenuation. On the other hand, sites that do require additional action generally include long-term adaptation strategies. Lastly, sites evaluated during the case closure process have found that they do not pose a risk to residual contamination at the site. Now I will be discussing two case studies. The first is an example of a site that is ready for closure, and the second is an example of a site that requires additional actions. The first case study is the mobile terminal site in West Oakland. You'll see here on the figure that the site is located within the Port of Oakland, the Bay Bridge is to the north, the Bay is to the west, and I-880 is to the east. It formerly operated as a bulk fuel terminal where underground and above ground tanks stored petroleum products at the site. Residual contamination consists of petroleum hydrocarbon impacts to soil, soil vapor, and groundwater. Source removal and remediation at the site consisted of free product removal, vapor extraction, and excavation. As groundwater rises, it's anticipated that the rising water table will encounter less impacted soil. Therefore, leaching is not currently an issue, as soil analytical results are less than cleanup goals. The second case study is the 2121 Wood Street site in West Oakland. You'll see that I-880 is located west of the site and West Grant Avenue is located to the north. The site formerly operated as a foundry and train station. It's being redeveloped with a mixed-use building with residential apartment units above ground floor commercial space. Shallow soil throughout the site is impacted with lead and to a lesser extent, heavy petroleum hydrocarbons. There are also some low-level groundwater impacts of petroleum and volatile organic compounds. The primary concern is direct contact with lead-affected soil. Rising groundwater is not expected to increase leaching given the low mobility of lead and low concentrations of petroleum. Given that the primary concern is direct contact with lead-affected soil, the remedy is an engineered cap and institutional controls. The engineered cap will consist of asphalt, hardscape, softscape, and bioswale areas. The institutional controls include a site management plan describing cap inspections and procedures during subsurface activities. A land use covenant will ensure implementation of the site management plan. The vulnerability assessment found that by 2050, the site may be inundated with 1 foot of sea level rise, and by 2100, up to 4.8 feet of sea level rise, with groundwater also being emergent at the time. Sea level rise and groundwater rise are not expected to alter cap effectiveness. However, emergent groundwater may have to be addressed depending on contaminant concentrations. The vulnerability assessment included recommendations to revise the document over time as conditions change. After reviewing vulnerability assessments, the next step is to determine whether additional actions are needed in response. Monitoring at cleanup sites that experience tidal and seasonal groundwater level fluctuations, similar to predicted groundwater rise, can reduce the uncertainties and improve our understanding of the potential for increased pollutant mobility and vapor production. In summary, by ensuring adequate primary and secondary source removal, using conservative screening levels to evaluate risk, and requiring necessary mitigation measures, any additional residual contamination that may remain at cleanup sites is unlikely to pose a future threat to human health or the environment as sea levels and groundwater rise. We require that vulnerability assessments be conducted at least every 5 years and reference the most current climate change documents. Our team will continue to encourage staff in the cleanup divisions to acquire vulnerability assessments where cleanup sites will potentially be impacted by sea level rise and groundwater rise in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Shall we turn to board member questions, or is there more? Touch the, to get the lights to come on. There we go. Now we can see one another. Dr. Gunther, do you want to lead off?
Yeah, I just really appreciate the starting with the ground level and sea level rise in 101 and working down to this example. And I want to encourage you guys to keep reminding me of these basics when you present. I'm still trying to get my head around the implications of this for our work. And I bet there are going to be surprises in the future. And there's an awful lot of information floating around already in the media that I think maybe applies in some places, but clearly doesn't apply in a lot of places. And so there's going to be a really impressive communications challenge here, both at the level of educating board members and also at helping people in specific locations understand the specific issues at their specific sites, like you described, Rachel. So I think this is going to be, you guys are going to need to sort of get your rap down and repeat it a lot in order to really get through to people. And I think this presentation is a great start. Thanks.
Thanks.
Yeah, I agree with that. It was a very helpful presentation. I know we've talked about it a little bit in the past. I didn't hear it in today's presentation, and I also am mindful of the opening comments about the hiring freeze. But what are we doing about closed sites, and to what extent do we have in place reopeners that allow us to do exactly the same vulnerability assessment on sites that are long closed, but which we never thought about this?
I'm Alec Noggle, Toxics Cleanup Division Chief. I think that's a great question, and that's one we've been considering quite a bit lately because it's been brought up also by other agencies and other proponents of this issue. Closed sites, again, I think the message that Jacob was giving is that we have had a what we call a low-threat closure process in place that dates back to 2009, and actually there was a version of that that dates back to the mid-90s. So, and it features source control as the primary component and leaching considerations. So closed cases that have met, and by and large, most of our closed cases, 90% plus, meet those criteria, we're not terribly concerned about, because what remains in place is low mobility. It had already been exposed to groundwater. It had leached. So we're not terribly concerned about those. However, closed sites where we didn't achieve those standards, that maybe where we had to cap the material or it was inaccessible, those are the ones we are concerned about, and we're actually beginning the process of inventorying what we have there. Reopening closed cases is very challenging because in many cases, the responsible party at the time has moved on, maybe sold the property. So who is left holding the bag is the property owner who didn't cause the problem, bought it because and got financing because we said it was okay and it was closed. So we have to deal with those one case at a time. I think that's the solution. Figure out and how we can work with local agencies, cities, counties, to support those property owners to reconsider what's going on at that property.
Are there any that we think are really serious ticking time bombs?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
Are there any that we worry are serious ticking time bombs?
No, not any specific. Again, we're doing the inventory. We know we've closed cases that had higher levels of residual in place because it just wasn't feasible economically or technically to get it, but we don't consider them ticking time bombs.
A regulatory term. Letty.
And maybe I'll just add, as you know, it's been in the news a lot. Actually, we do get a lot of calls about this. When I was at the Hunters Point Record of Decision media event a week and a half ago, that was the first question that came out of the reporter's mouth to me, that Martha's like, Aileen, that's for you, with regard to the site and how sea level rise is going to impact it. And there is financial constraints that we have at the Water Board. Do want to let you know there was a panel convened last week, and it was an assembly committee that convened the panel, and Dr. Christina Hill was one of the people on the panel, and kind of wanting to understand the scope of groundwater rise, sea level rise on cleanup sites in California, as they were trying to brainstorm about what legislation may be necessary to really deal with this issue. So at some point in the future, there could be some more money that would come out of it. So that there, it is getting more, and this was planned before some of these events came up, before Hurricane Helene hit, Hurricane Milton, and before we even knew about this Senate committee. But it's getting more and more in the news, and more people are aware. And we do have our talking points down that we continue to revise with new information. But one thing that could come out is the legislator may try to propose something. We at the Water Board don't comment on legislation, but we do provide factual information. And just for background, Region 2 by far has the most number of cleanup sites within the state of California, within the 9 regions that will be impacted by groundwater rise and sea level rise.
Yeah, I just wanted to circle back to the budget question that you brought up at the beginning. And I don't know if we have this. I would like to see, I mean, just as I looked at the map and I looked at the number of people presenting, and if I put the number of people as the denominator and the map as the numerator, the number of sites per staff member are almost absurd. And now, obviously, we're prioritizing and filtering, you know, but some sense of the scale of the tasks that we face, and this is not the only one, where we have just a huge workload and a relatively small number of people addressing that, I think is something, at least, I don't want to go publicly whining about it, I'm not sure that helps, but I personally would like to understand a little more about the ratio that we face as we move forward, you know, just dealing with the existing problem, and now we have an emerging problem, to get my head around how much work there is, and if I understand things correctly, how few people there are to actually do it.
Yeah, we recognize that problem from the start, and it's one of the reasons, it's probably the main reason we formed the technical team that delivered this presentation today, to support our staff. Now, we have, between our cleanup program, our military program, and our underground storage tank program, we have nearly 40 staff in the two divisions dedicated to be what we call cleanup case managers. So we've got a lot of staff doing this. We have probably over 1,000 sites in those three programs combined that they're dealing with. So the strategy is to incorporate these activities into our day-to-day, month-to-month case management so that it's, you know, it's being absorbed through that concept. But that's the only way we could do it. We can't stop what we're doing, stop the investigations and the cleanups and the vapor intrusion concerns to deal with it, to deal just with this. So we had to absorb it and integrate it. And I think we're doing a great job. It's 2 years on now since we started, this team was formed and put their recommendations out. But we could always use more.
And I just want to, one, thank Alec, who's the manager of our groundwater toxics team, and Jessica Watkins, who's our manager of our groundwater team, for really their staff working collaboratively. And just to add on to what Alec said, right, we have about 40 staff, and because you like numbers and he said 1,000, I do have some numbers for you, Dr. Gunther. So I was expecting the question, how many sites of those sites, Eileen, are impacted by 2 feet of sea level rise in Region 2? 143 sites. Compared to the Central Coast region, they have zero. Region 5, Central Valley, zero. You know, I can go on, you know, LA region has 29. How many of the sites in our region are impacted by 3 feet of sea level rise? 207. How many by 4 feet of sea level rise? 269. 5 feet of sea level rise? 367. So the magnitude of the problem in Region 2 far outscales anything else in the other regions of California. And I think Alec and Jessica deserve a lot of credit and their team for doing a great job prioritizing, looking at it, and we're getting the word out to the communities. Ross was with me, also want to commend Ross. We were at a Hunters Point meeting several times with the community, and the question keeps coming up. I was at a meeting a couple weeks ago in the evening in Richmond, the question comes up. So it's in the news, and then people get scared, and then they start, you know, so our main message is letting them know that we're dealing with it. There's nothing right now, a crisis issue, but it takes time, and fortunately, we have some time with sea level rise and climate change, and we're working on it.
No, I think we covered the things that I was interested in. Mark?
I just had a quick question about the numbers. So did I hear it right that 13 of the vulnerable assessments have been requested and 8 have come in? Did I hear that right?
I believe that was correct. 13 sites where we have that essentially have not gone through or met the low threat closure standards, so that we put them in a special bucket.
Okay.
And where contaminants, post-remediation,
right,
contamination residual has been left in place,
okay,
that is a concern. So we've asked those responsible parties to do these vulnerability assessments.
Yeah.
Now, that's a number that's growing.
Right. I was going to say it's got to be growing.
Yeah, it's growing. We started this about a year ago when we patterned it after what we did for landfills a couple of years ago. So
okay,
it's on the rise.
Thank you.
My two questions had to do with the universe, which kind of follows on Dr. Gunther's question. And I think it's just useful for the teams in presenting to the board, especially as we, you know, go through this particular recurring budget cycle, for us to have a feel for how many staff are applied to a given program and what's the universe that we're trying to tackle in different ways. So let's keep some of those metrics in mind for future presentations. And I think we all very much appreciated the technical team's presentation today. I'm also interested, but not at this very moment, in what are the mechanisms, both regulatory and other, that we use to elicit the response from those engaged in this work?
Yeah, it ranges from, if we're dealing with cooperative dischargers, responsibility parties, to just asking and making requests, all the way up to using our regulatory tools like Water Code Section 13267 directives, mm-hmm. or even 13304 cleanup and abatement orders, putting tasks in there for those things. We kind of, the life cycle of a case takes many years, as we presented last mm-hmm. spring, and we have a lot of on-ramps, ways to get at it at different times during investigation, during the submittal of a remedial action plan. We can request or require this to be assessed, or a lot of cases are already beyond that at the time of closure, so we're doing those evaluations ourselves at that time.
So many of you have a long and storied history at the Water Board, which is wonderful. The board members come and go, don't we? And so I think it's always useful to remind us of what are the mechanisms that we use applicable to a given program presentation, so that you're always trying to bring us up to speed on the tools that you're deploying and the universe of the problem that you're trying to wrap your arms around. So if there's no further comment or question, including from Jane, I think we very much appreciate the time you gave to preparing and giving us this presentation. And let's move to our next item, agenda item 7, which is the total maximum daily load program update.
Great. Thank you, Chair Hacker. So total maximum daily loads are action plans to restore water quality by defining the maximum amount of a pollutant that can be allowed to enter a water body and have the water body meet water quality standards. This item will provide an update on the total maximum daily load program, including a summary of the TMDL development process, as well as our efforts prioritizing, developing, and completing TMDLs. Setney Busicott-Fruch, Senior Water Resource Control Engineer in the Planning Division, will provide the presentation. Thank you, Setney.
Good morning, Chair Strauss-Hacker and members of the board. Delighted to be here this morning to provide you with an update on the Total Maximum Daily Loads program. Total Maximum Daily Loads are also referred to as TMDLs in short. The purpose of the TMDL program is to protect water quality and public health. I will start my talk by briefly explaining what TMDLs are, how they come to be, how they are developed, and then implemented in our region. In terms of available staff resources to run this program, until recently, the TMDL program was allocated 8 full-time staff and 60% of another staff's time, so 8.6 person year. With the recent budget cuts, we are down to 7.6 person year. So what is a TMDL? The TMDL establishes the maximum cumulative load for a pollutant that a specific water body can assimilate and still support its beneficial uses. A TMDL is much more than evaluating sources and loads, however. It is the roadmap to improve water quality. It must explain the relationship between the loading and the water quality problem, which is referred to as the linkage analysis. The TMDL allocates loads to point sources, such as wastewater treatment plants and industries, and to non-point sources, such as agricultural lands. It includes an implementation plan to reduce pollutant loading and attain standards. It incorporates implementation and effectiveness monitoring to evaluate progress toward attainment. This slide shows the key components of the TMDL process. TMDLs are a requirement under Section 303D of the Clean Water Act. which mandates that states must identify water bodies that are impaired, that is, that are not meeting standards, and develop water quality restoration plans for the pollutant causing the impairment. Moreover, state's Porter-Cologne Water Quality Control Act integrates TMDL programs as a key strategy to address water quality impairments. Planning Division is responsible for assessing attainment of water quality and standards in San Francisco Bay and its streams. Water quality standards serve as the foundation of water quality protection and are found in the basin plan. You can think of the water quality standards as a three-legged stool. They describe the beneficial uses of a water body to be protected, such as water contact recreation, drinking water supply, or aquatic life. They set numeric and narrative water quality objectives necessary to protect those beneficial uses, and they establish provisions to prevent degradation of existing water quality. We collect and compare monitoring data to assess whether our objectives are met. We classify waters that do not meet standards as impaired and place them on an impaired waters list. This list is known as the 303D list, referring to the Clean Water Act section. We develop TMDLs to resolve the impairments and restore water quality. The scientific basis of the TMDLs gets peer-reviewed by an independent external scientific review panel, and the TMDLs and basin plan amendments undergo extensive public review and comment process. Once they are adopted by the regional board, approved by the state board, the Office of Administrative Law, and the Environmental Protection Agency, we implement the TMDLs through our water board's regulatory programs. My next few slides show how we use monitoring data to determine if beneficial uses are supported. In the example here, we analyze indicator bacteria data to determine if popular beaches or rivers are safe for activities like swimming, kayaking, and paddleboarding. In order to protect sport fishing beneficial uses, we analyze data on whether fish are safe to eat. The web image on the left comes from our water quality portal, where public can see vast array of sport fish data collected across California. The interactive map shown on the right allows you to explore fish contaminant levels in your favorite fishing spot, showing data from monitoring by the Surface Water Ambient Monitoring, or SWAMP program, and other studies. In order to protect aquatic life beneficial uses, we assess water quality data throughout our basin. The photograph on the left shows our swamp staff collecting flow and suspended sediment data in Walker Creek to monitor for mercury concentrations in sediment so we can evaluate the impairment status of Walker Creek's beneficial uses, including warm and cold habitat and wildlife habitat. The photograph on the right shows planning staff collecting data on the volume of fine sediment in pools in the Pescadero watershed. This data allows us to evaluate whether there's too much sediment in salmon-bearing streams to impair cold freshwater habitat beneficial use. These are examples of how we use water quality data to determine if regional waters are in good condition. Every few years, we conduct a formal, transparent analysis, as directed by the Clean Water Act and state policy, to systematically assess all available water quality data from a large variety of sources. We completed this very analysis in 2024. The data sources we assessed include the Bay Regional Monitoring Program, Surface Water Ambient Monitoring Program, stormwater programs around the bay, and other sources. We then compare these data against water quality objectives and other scientifically appropriate defensible evaluation guidelines. We rely on our listing policy to determine whether a water body should be placed on the 303D list for that pollutant water body combination. Now, before I provide more details on the current 303D list, let me explain what the colors mean on this chart. The blue shows impairments that were listed prior to 2024. The red shows impairments that are listed in the 2024 cycle. Blue old, red new impairments. This bar chart shows the impairments by pollutant category and illustrates the newly added impairments in red. The new list identified 490 pollutant water body combinations in our region. This represents about a 40% increase in the number of listings in the current 303D cycle. The largest number of impairments in our region are due to legacy pesticides. These are chlordane, DDT, and dieldrin, followed by metals and nutrients. Nutrients also represent the largest number of pollutant category added in this cycle. Nutrients category includes ammonia, chlorophyll A, eutrophication, nitrite, nitrates, and dissolved oxygen listings as well. The next impairment down the list is toxic organics. These include polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, PAHs, dioxin compounds, and many other organic compounds. The other cause category includes temperature, pH, benthic community effects, and invasive species. I would like to clarify that the 40% increase in listing this year does not imply that there has been a rapid decline in water quality in our region. There are several reasons for this increase, but the key reasons include the significant volume of newly generated data in the last 10 years that we assessed, and some of these listings being based on data that were not necessarily representative of the entire watershed. They were more like a snapshot in time and place. In this graphic, green shows existing TMDLs, and purple shows impairments that require attention. Of the 490 impairments in our region, about 230, or approximately half of them, have been addressed and by completed TMDLs, as shown in green. About one half of the impairments are in creeks and rivers and result from urban pesticides, trash, sediment, indicator bacteria, and nutrients. Our bay listings constitute one-fifth of total impairments and include PCBs, mercury, and other contaminants such as selenium. Within impaired lakes and reservoirs, mercury and PCBs exceed safe levels for recreationally caught sport fish. And about 15 beaches are impaired for indicator bacteria. That leaves us with about 260 impairments requiring attention, as shown in purple. 260 impairments represent a trying workload challenge considering our existing resources. We consider the following factors in selecting which TMDLs to work on: the nature and severity of impacts on water quality, complexity and successful implementation, the needs of disadvantaged and underserved communities, and the anticipated impacts due to climate change. In addition to selecting TMDLs to work on, this framework is also helpful and allows us to identify waters that may not be the prime targets for TMDLs, which are resource intensive. Some impairments can be addressed by implementing targeted actions directly, by a TMDL alternative, such as a water quality restoration plan, by delistings based on more data collection, by standards action, or by permitting actions. We have developed and are implementing 22 TMDLs designed to improve water quality in the region. The completed TMDLs are shown on this map. These TMDLs collectively address over 230, or about half of the current impairments. Three TMDLs have a large focus. These are mercury and PCB TMDLs in San Francisco Bay and pesticides in urban creeks that apply throughout the region. These are mostly legacy pollutants and are difficult to control at the source because they were used so widely, and thus the timelines for achieving their targets are long. We also have six TMDLs to address sediment, which can impair fish spawning, migration, and habitat in creeks. Nine bacteria TMDLs to restore recreational uses of beaches and water bodies. Mercury TMDLs for Guadalupe River, Walker Creek, and Tomales Bay, which are related to historic mercury mining in those watersheds. And we have a selenium TMDL for the North Bay. All of these TMDLs are in some stage of implementation, and the challenge is managing and tracking them and incorporating new TMDLs as they are developed. On that note, we are currently working on developing five TMDLs, TMDL alternatives or water quality improvement plans. In the next 3 years, we anticipate asking the board to consider three TMDLs or water quality improvement plans. These would address pathogens in six beaches along San Francisco Bay in Foster City and South San Francisco. We are also working on dissolved oxygen impairments in Lake Merritt in Oakland and in Suisun Creek. At the same time, we are reviewing the mercury and PCB TMDLs in San Francisco Bay that were approved in 2008 and 2010 and that are currently being implemented via various programs. We anticipate proposing revisions to the timelines and implementation strategies for these TMDLs in the next 5 to 6 years. Even though TMDLs are regulatory and become part of the basin plan, they are not self-implementing. All our TMDLs include an implementation plan with actions needed to achieve load reductions. Implementation actions identified in a TMDL are incorporated into existing programs, such as NPDES permits for wastewater or stormwater. But sometimes they require us to develop new permits or programs. For instance, in the agricultural lands program, we have created a grazing program to achieve load reductions required by the stream sediment and pathogen TMDLs. The Water Board uses waste discharge requirements or conditional waivers of waste discharge requirements to enroll landowners into these new programs. Grazing waivers have been in place for the Tomales Bay, Napa River, and Sonoma Creek watersheds. Later this year, we will be bringing a revised grazing waiver for approval to this board that will also include Petaluma River watershed. Of the 7.6 person years in the TMDL program, four full-time staff implements the action plans. When we do pass implementation the other divisions, we support them with compliance. The TMDL program coordinates with all the sections in the planning division and with almost all the divisions at the Water Board. As the section leader of this program, I am delighted to work with such talented and committed staff and to collaborate across many divisions to improve water quality. This concludes my presentation. Thank you for your time and attention, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Satnai. Board questions and comments. Bill.
So this is going to be a dumb question, but I've always kind of wondered, when you have a TMDL, how do you decide, as between lots of different contributors of a particular contaminant, how do you decide what level a particular discharger is allowed to actually put out so as to achieve the TMDL?
Well, it depends, is the answer. However, I can give two examples. For example, for the Pescadero Creek sediment TMDL, we evaluated the total loads coming in, and we identified what the land uses that contributes those loads are, and then we saw that we needed an 80% reduction, and we applied it to all the dischargers across the board. For the PCB TMDL, for instance, for the wastewater component, we looked at the all the number of different wastewater dischargers, about 104 inputting, and we looked at their fractional contribution and decided based on their contribution to the total, and came up with a reduction.
And do you ever make sort of discharger specific adjustments? This particular activity that's being regulated has a higher value or importance than some other? It's one of those questions I've always sort of wondered about. Maybe it's an academic question that doesn't come up in reality because discharges are similarly situated, but I imagine there are variations between folks. So, or do you just simply do it on a pro rata basis across everyone?
It hasn't come up that way so far, and there may be differences in their level of treatment, for instance, but that hasn't been incorporated into allocations yet.
Great, thank you.
I think we first look, you have to look at the loads from all the sources.
Sure.
Once you identify the loads from all the sources and then what you need to get to, that's when you go to the allocations and you have to look. Some sources have higher loads, so they're going to have to reduce more than other sources.
Yeah, okay. Thanks. It's one of those questions I've always wondered about. So.
Well, we'll pay close attention as you bring other items forward. Board Member Boddy.
Thanks for a great presentation. I just wanted to get a sense of this so we have the TMDL put together. I know that we're working with the RCDs and private owners throughout the watershed lands, but once the TMDL is out there, how long does it take to achieve compliance, or is that like an ongoing vision of a goal? Can you talk a little bit about that?
The answer is also, it depends. So, we do have, we're looking at the Napa River right now, the sediment TMDL, and we're evaluating that as well as the Sonoma Creek sediment TMDL. And we're actually hoping to be able to delist within 5 years. So that has taken less than 20 years to get there. Now you go to the PCBs and mercuries, some of these legacy pollutants. We're not going to be able to achieve or make that attainment in 20 years. It's going to take longer. So it really depends on the science and the number of actions and how long it really takes for those actions to have an effect.
I appreciate that. And I can just say there are several TMDLs on the coast side right now in San Mateo County. And while it may take a while to get to compliance, it does provide a roadmap and clear goals and boundaries on what we're trying to achieve. So thank you for that work.
Can I add a point to address Jane Batty's question? As you're very familiar with the Pescadero sediment TMDL, for example, it's not just the end goal. There's so much that happens along the process. Like once the TMDL was established there, which laid the scientific basis for what is going on in the watershed and what we need to do, and because of the work we put in to work together, collaborate with the RCD and the landowners, a lot of restoration had already started happening even before the board adopted the TMDL. So even the fact that we start working on it really results in water quality actions and improvements.
Can I just say, I think it's a really good presentation. I think I need to hear it all over again. It's good.
It'll be recorded.
Yeah. Other comments?
Just a question concerning the budget. Obviously, the program has been put together and has been working, and that's fine. And I'm hearing that we have a reduction. Is that affecting our, I don't know about maybe the flexibility or just our ability to react to some of the other things that maybe occur simply, for the homeless, for instance, if they're having issues, we have the TMDLs established, but then if we have a spike or whatever else, are we able to respond to that, or is that just part of the program?
It's part of the program. I'd say no. The staffing reductions that we've had to date are across all our programs. And so the TMDL program's not alone. The groundwater group lost staff. The toxics group lost staff. So they're not alone. And I just think as far as some of the lower priority work within the organization is just going to be pushed back longer as we try. And we will always have staff available to deal with our highest priority work or anything emergency, kind of like in response to the speaker earlier today. If there was something that was truly a public health crisis or a serious environmental issue, we have the staff to deal with that. It's like some of the other TMDLs we won't get to that are maybe not as urgent, but no. And really the homeless issue, a lot of that comes into play with our stormwater program. And we'll be having another update on that in December with regard to Caltrans and their cease and desist order. That's a big issue they deal with on their right-of-ways as they work to remove pollution to protect water quality.
Certainly. Thanks for a lovely presentation. I think that it's such an interesting vantage point in planning to have so many programs touch implementation and how much your team is engaged in implementation. And when you next bring an item before the board, I think going back and helping board members understand allocations, the linkage analysis, and then the allocations and how they're derived and the emphasis on the implementation plan itself will all help us with our collective understanding. So terrific presentation. Thank you so much. And so much being done over time by this board in this program that continues to inform us. And so with that.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Can I ask a question?
Go ahead.
If you take the number of impairments in the numerator and the number of staff in the denominator. Okay. This is a recurring theme.
Yeah.
I was struck by, and again, this... I was struck by the number of new listings for metals, which are kind of a something we've been measuring for a long time. So I'm struck that is this simply a matter of the fact that we are making measurements in water bodies we haven't made measurements before, and like lo and behold, the mercury's there, or is that what that one represents?
Yeah, I think it's a couple of things. And so one factor, which is a little complicated to explain, is there are more water body segments that we were monitoring now.
Yeah. Okay.
Kind of used to have a simplistic view of the world. Napa River was one giant 65-mile segment.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're starting to get more data in tributaries, and adding those to our mapping regime, those end up being analyzed now as separate water body segments. So in some cases, this expansion on the list is a function of our mapping regime. I would say for heavy metals, we didn't see a lot of new data that tell us a problem is growing or expanding with that pollutant type.
Okay, great, because I think that it really, really reflects well upon us that, I mean, we could address this problem in a different way. We could simply not make as many measurements in as many places. And lo and behold, we have fewer impairments. So I think that it reflects really well on us that that's not our approach, but our approach is to document the actual scale of the problem and deal with it as best we can. And that really came across very clearly in your presentation. And, you know, we have been at this for a long time. And at one point I was engaged deeply in this in the early 2000s. And it's great to hear that, in fact, there may be some delisting coming. There have been a few instances of that. But I want us to make sure that we don't treat delisting as the indicator of success of this program on any kind of timescale that's relevant, you know, right? It's a future target that we will get to, but just the fact that we are honestly and thoroughly documenting the problem is, to me, an indicator of a very, very sophisticated and thoughtful approach to the reality that we face.
I think you've spared us all the intensity of your engagement during the 303D listing process with State Board, with the other boards that were involved in what would be proposed for listing and why it would be proposed for listing, and an enormous amount of behind-the-scenes work that the board was sheltered from in getting to those new listings. And so over the last couple of decades, how the nine boards and State Board go about the listing process has evolved, and it would be, in a couple of years, good for you to brief the board on how we go about doing that. But you're spared for a couple of years since we just went through this. With that, I think our work today is done. I wanted to thank our attorneys and our AGB team and all of the board managers and staff. Thank you so much for your participation today and for the public who joined us. This will conclude the public session of this meeting. We're not meeting in closed session. Thank you for joining us. And our next meeting is scheduled for November 13th in this auditorium. Thank you.